It's the law. You have to attend. And anyway, it's better for you to be present. It's easier for a jury to convict an absent defendant. But, Kaya, it won't be for much longer.
That doesn't make me feel any better. Don't you see? What comes next is worse than this.
We don't know that. Don't forget, we can appeal if this doesn't go our way.
Kaya didn't answer. Thoughts of an appeal sickened her more. The same forced march through different courtrooms, farther from the marsh. Probably large towns. Some gulless sky. Tom stepped out of the room and returned with a glass of sweet iced tea and a package of salted peanuts. She sipped at the tea, refused the nuts. A few minutes later, the bailiff knocked on the door and led them back into court. Kaya's mind faded in and out of reality, catching only snippets of the testimony.
"Sheriff Jackson," Tom said, "the prosecution is claiming that Miss Clark snuck out of her motel late at night and walked from the Three Mountains Motel to the bus station, a trip of at least 20 minutes, that she then took the 11:50 p.m. night bus from Greenville to Barkley Cove, but the bus was late, so she couldn't have arrived in Barkley until 1:40 a.m. They claim that from the Barkley bus stop, she walked to the town wharf 3 or 4 minutes, then she boated to the cove near the water tower, at least 20 minutes, walked to the tower, another 8 minutes, climbed it in pitch dark, say 4 to 5 minutes at least, opened the grate a few seconds, waited for Chase, no time estimate, and then all of this in reverse. Those actions would have taken 1 hour, 7 minutes minimum, and that does not count time supposedly waiting for Chase. But the bus back to Greenville, which she had to catch, departed only 50 minutes after she arrived. Therefore, it is a simple fact. There was not enough time for her to commit this alleged crime. Isn't that correct, Sheriff?
It would have been tight, that's true. But she could have jogged from her boat to the tower and back. She could have cut a minute here and there.
A minute here and there won't do it. She would have needed 20 extra minutes. At least. How could she have saved 20 minutes?
Well, maybe she didn't go in her boat at all. Maybe she walked or ran from the bus stop on Main down the sandy track to the tower. That would be much quicker than going by sea.
From his seat at the prosecution table, Eric Chastain glared at the sheriff. He had convinced the jury there was enough time for Kaya to commit the crime and return to the bus. They didn't need much convincing. In addition, they had a superior witness, the shrimper, who testified that he had seen Miss Clark headed to the tower by boat.
"Do you have any evidence whatsoever that Miss Clark went by land to the tower, Sheriff?"
"No, but going by land is a good theory."
"Theory?"
Tom turned to the jury.
"The time for theories was before you arrested Miss Clark, before you held her in jail for 2 months. The fact is, you cannot prove that she went by land, and there was not enough time for her to go by sea." "No more questions."
Eric faced the sheriff for the cross.
"Sheriff, isn't it true that the waters near Barkley Cove are subjected to strong currents, riptides, and undertows that can influence the speed of a boat?"
"Yeah, that's true. Everybody lives here knows that."
"Someone who knew how to take advantage of such a current could boat very quickly to the tower from the harbor. In such a case, it would be very feasible to cut 20 minutes off the round trip. Isn't that correct?"
Eric was annoyed that he had to suggest yet another theory, but all he needed was some plausible concept the jurors could latch onto and pull them in.
"Yeah, that's correct. Thank you."
As soon as Eric turned from the witness stand, Tom stood for the redirect.
Sheriff, yes or no, do you have any evidence that a current, riptide, or strong wind occurred on the night of October 29th to the 30th that could have decreased the time for someone to boat from the Barclay Cove Harbor to the fire tower, or any evidence that Miss Clark went to the tower by land? No, but I'm sure that... Sheriff, it doesn't make any difference what you're sure of or not. Do you have any evidence that a strong riptide was flowing the night of October 29th, 1969? No, I don't.
Chapter 53. Missing Link. 1970. The next morning, Tom had only one more witness, his last card. He called Tim O'Neill, who had operated his own shrimping boat in the waters off Barclay Cove for 38 years. Tim, nearing 65, tall yet stout, had thick brown hair with only whispers of gray, yet a full beard, nearly white. Folks knew him to be quiet and serious, honest and gracious, always opening doors for ladies. The perfect last witness.
Tim, is it correct that on the night of October 29th to the 30th of last year, you were skippering your boat into Barclay Cove Harbor at approximately 1:45 to 2 o'clock a.m.?
Yes.
Two of your crew members, Mr. Hal Miller, who testified here, and Mr. Alan Hunt, who signed an affidavit, both claim they saw Miss Clark motoring north past the harbor in her boat at approximately the times mentioned. Are you aware of their declarations?
Yes.
Did you see the same boat at that same time and place that both Mr. Miller and Mr. Hunt saw?
Yes, I did.
And do you agree with their statements that it was Miss Clark in her boat that you saw motoring north?
No, I do not.
Why not?
It was dark. There was no moon until later, and that boat was too far away to recognize with any certainty. I know everybody round here with that kind of boat, and I've seen Miss Clark in hers plenty of times, and known right away it was her. But that night, it was too dark to recognize that boat or who was in it.
Thank you, Tim. No more questions.
Eric walked up close to the witness stand.
Tim, even if you could not identify that boat, or who exactly was in it, do you agree that a rig about the same size and shape as Miss Clark's boat was headed toward the Barclay Cove fire tower at approximately 1:45 a.m. the night Chase Andrews died at the fire tower around that time?
Yes. I can say the boat was a similar shape and size as Miss Clark's.
Thank you very much.
On redirect, Tom rose and spoke from where he stood.
Tim, to confirm, you testified that you have recognized Miss Clark in her boat many times, but on that evening you saw nothing at all to identify that boat or boater to be Miss Clark in her rig. Correct?
Correct.
And can you tell us, are there very many boats the same size and shape as Miss Clark's boat operating in this area?
Oh, yes. Hers is one of the most common types of boat around. There's lots of boats just like hers operating here.
So the boater you saw that night could have been any number of other persons in a similar boat?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Your Honor. The defense rests.
Judge Sims said,
"We'll recess for 20 minutes. Court dismissed."
For his closing, Eric wore a tie with wide gold and burgundy stripes. The gallery was quietly expectant as he approached the jury and stood at the railing, passing his eyes deliberately from one to the next.
"Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you are members of a community, of a proud and unique town. Last year, you lost one of your own sons, a young man,
a shining star of your neighborhood, looking forward to a long life with his beautiful...
Kaya barely heard him as he repeated his account of how she murdered Chase Andrews. She sat, elbows on the table, her head in her hands, catching only fragments of his discourse.
Two well-known men in this community saw Miss Clark and Chase in the woods. Heard her say in the words, "I will kill you." A red wool cap that left fibers on his denim jacket. Who else would want to remove that necklace?
You know these currents and winds can drastically increase the speed.
We know from her lifestyle that she is very capable of boating at night, of climbing the tower in the dark. It all fits together like clockwork. Every single move she made that night is clear. You can and must find that the defendant is guilty of first-degree murder. Thank you for doing your duty.
Judge Sims nodded at Tom, who approached the jury box.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I grew up in Barkley Cove, and when I was a younger man, I heard the tall tales about the Marsh Girl. Yes, let's just get this out in the open. We called her the Marsh Girl. Many still call her that. Some people whispered that she was part wolf, or the missing link between ape and man, that her eyes glowed in the dark. Yet in reality, she was only an abandoned child, a little girl surviving on her own in a swamp, hungry and cold. But we didn't help her. Except for one of her only friends, Jumpin', not one of our churches or community groups offered her food or clothes. Instead, we labeled and rejected her because we thought she was different. But ladies and gentlemen, did we exclude Miss Clark because she was different, or was she different because we excluded her? If we had taken her in as one of our own, I think that is what she would be today. If we had fed, clothed, and loved her, invited her into our churches and homes, we wouldn't be prejudiced against her, and I believe she would not be sitting here today accused of a crime. The job of judging this shy, rejected young woman has fallen on your shoulders, but you must base that judgment on the facts presented in this case, in this courtroom, not on rumors or feelings from the past 24 years. What are the true and solid facts?
Just as with the prosecution, Kaya's mind caught only snippets.
The prosecution has not even proved that this incident was indeed a murder and not simply a tragic accident. No murder weapon, no wounds from being pushed, no witnesses, no fingerprints. One of the most important and proven facts is that Miss Clark has a sound alibi. We know she was in Greenville the night Chase died. No evidence that she dressed as a man, bust to Barkley. In fact, the prosecution has failed to prove that she was in Barkley Cove that night at all. Failed to prove that she went to the tower. I say again. There is not one single piece of evidence that proves Miss Clark was on the fire tower, in Barkley Cove, or killed Chase Andrews. And the skipper, Mr. O'Neill, who has operated his own shrimp boat for 38 years, testified that it was too dark to identify that boat. Fibers on his jacket, which could have been there for 4 years. These are uncontested facts. Not one of the witnesses for the prosecution was sure of what they saw. Not one. Yet in her defense, every witness is 100% certain.
Tom stood for a moment in front of the jury.
I know most of you very well. And I know you can set aside any former prejudices against Miss Clark. Even though she only went to school one day in her life,
because the other children harassed her. She educated herself and became a well-known naturalist and author. We called her the Marsh Girl. Now, scientific institutions recognize her as the Marsh Expert. I believe you can put all of the rumors and tall tales aside. I believe you will come to a judgment based on the facts you heard in this courtroom, not the false rumors you have heard for years. It is time, at last, for us to be fair to the Marsh Girl.
Chapter 54 Vice Versa 1970 Motioning toward mismatched chairs in a small conference room, Tom offered seats to Tate, Jody, Scupper, and Robert Foster. They sat around the rectangular table, stained with coffee mug circles. The walls were two tones of flaking plaster, lime green around the top, dark green around the bottom. An odor of dankness, as much from the walls as from the marsh, permeated.
"You can wait in here," Tom said, closing the door behind him. "There's a coffee machine down the hall across from the assessor's, but it's not fit for a three-eyed mule. The diner has okay coffee. Let's see, it's a little after 11. We'll make a plan for lunch later."
Tate walked to the window, which was crisscrossed with a mesh of white bars, as if other verdict waiters had tried escape. He asked Tom,
"Where'd they take Kaya? To her cell? Does she have to wait in there alone?" "Yes, she's in her cell. I'm going to see her now." "How long do you think the jury will take?"
Robert asked.
"It's impossible to say. When you think it'll be quick, they take days and vice versa. Most of them have probably already decided, and not in Kai's favor. If a few jurors have doubts and try to convince the others that guilt has not been proven definitively, we have a chance."
They nodded silently, weighed down by the word definitively, as though guilt had been proven, just not absolutely.
"Okay," Tom continued. "I'm going to see Kaya and then get to work. I have to prepare the appeals request and even a motion for a mistrial due to prejudice. Please keep in mind, if she's convicted, this is not the end of the road, not by any means. I'll be in and out, and I'll certainly let you know if there's any news."
"Thanks," Tate said, then added, "Please tell Kaya we're here. And we'll sit with her if she wants." This, though she had refused to see anyone but Tom for the last few days, and almost no one for 2 months.
"Sure, I'll tell her."
Tom left. Jumpin' and Mabel had to wait for the verdict outside among the palmettos and sawgrass of the square, along with the few other blacks. Just as they spread colorful quilts on the ground and unpacked biscuits and sausage from paper bags, a rain shower sent them grabbing things and running for cover under the overhang of the Sing Oil. Mr. Lane shouted that they had to wait outside, a fact they'd known for 100 years, and not get in the way of any customers. Some whites crowded in the diner or the doggone for coffee, and others clustered in the street beneath bright umbrellas. Kids splashed in sudden puddles and ate cracker jacks, expecting a parade. Tutored by millions of minutes alone, Kaya thought she knew lonely. A life of staring at the old kitchen table, into empty bedrooms, across endless stretches of sea and grass. No one to share the joy of a found feather or a finished watercolor. Reciting poetry to gulls. But after Jacob closed her cell with the clank of bars, disappeared down the hall and locked the heavy door with a final thud, a cold silence settled. Waiting for the verdict of her own murder trial brought a loneliness of a different order. The question of whether she lived or died did not surface on her mind, but sank beneath the greater fear of years alone without her marsh. No gulls, no sea in a starless place. The annoying cellmates down the hall had been released. She almost missed their constant nattering, a human presence no matter how lowly. Now she alone inhabited this long cement tunnel of locks and bars. She knew the scale of the prejudices against her, and that an early verdict would mean there had been little deliberation, which would mean conviction. Lockjaw came to mind, the twisting, tortured life of being doomed. Kaya thought of moving the crate under the window and searching for raptors over the marsh. Instead, she just sat there, in the silence. 2 hours later, at 1 in the afternoon, Tom opened the door into the room where Tate, Jody, Scupper, and Robert Foster waited.
"Well, there's some news."
"What?"
Tate jerked his head up. "Not a verdict already." No, not a verdict. But I think it's good news. The jurors have asked to see the court record of the bus driver's testimonies. This means, at least, they're thinking things through, not simply jumping to a verdict. The bus driver's a key, of course, and both said they were certain Kaya was not on their respective buses, and weren't certain about the disguises either. Sometimes seeing testimony in black and white makes it more definitive to the jurors. We'll see, but it's a glimmer of hope.
"We'll take a glimmer," Jody said.
"Look, it's past lunchtime. Why don't y'all go over to the diner? I promise I'll get you if anything happens."
"I don't think so," Tate said.
"They'll all be talking about how guilty she is over there." "I understand. I'll send my clerk for some burgers. How's that?"
"Fine, thanks," Scupper said, and pulled some dollars from his wallet.
At 2:15, Tom returned to tell them the jurors had asked to see the coroner's testimony.
"I'm not sure if this is favorable or not."
"Shit," Tate swore.
"How does anybody live through this?" "Try to relax. This may take days. I'll keep you posted."
Unsmiling and drawn, Tom opened the door again at 4 o'clock.
"Well, gentlemen, the jurors have a verdict. The judge has ordered everyone back to the courtroom."
Tate stood.
"What does it mean? Happening so fast like this?"
"Come on, Tate."
Jody touched his arm.
"Let's go."
In the hallway, they joined the stream of townspeople jostling shoulder to shoulder from outside. Dank air, smelling of cigarette smoke, rain-wet hair, and damp clothes flowed with them. The courtroom filled in less than 10 minutes. Many couldn't get a seat and bunched in the hall or on the front steps. At 4:30, the bailiff led Kaya toward her seat. For the first time, he supported her by her elbow, and indeed, it appeared she might drop if he did not. Her eyes never moved from the floor. Tate watched every twitch in her face. His breath labored against nausea. Miss Jones, the recorder, entered and took her seat. Then, like a funeral choir, solemn and cheerless, the jurors filed into their box. Mrs. Culpepper glanced at Kaya. The others kept their eyes ahead. Tom tried to read their faces. There was not one cough or shuffle from the gallery.
"All rise."
Judge Sims's door opened, and he sat at his bench.
"Please be seated. Mr. Foreman, is it correct that the jury has reached a verdict?"
Mr. Tomlinson, a quiet man who owned the Buster Brown shoe shop, stood in the first row.
"We have, Your Honor."
Judge Sims looked at Kaya.
Would the defendant please rise for the reading of the verdict?
Tom touched Kaya's arm, then guided her up. Tate placed his hand on the railing as close to Kaya as he could get. Jumpin' lifted Mabel's hand and held it. No one in the room had ever experienced this collective heart-pounding, this shared lack of breath. Eyes shifted, hands sweated. The Shrimper crew, Hal Miller, nodded his mind, fighting to confirm that it truly was Miss Clark's boat he had seen that night. Suppose he'd been wrong. Most stared not at the back of Kaya's head, but at the floor, the walls. It seemed that the village, not Kaya, awaited judgment. And few felt the salacious joy they had expected at this juncture. The foreman, Mr. Tomlinson, handed a small piece of paper to the bailiff, who passed it to the judge. He unfolded it and read it with a vacant face. The bailiff then took it from Judge Sims and handed it to Miss Jones, the recorder.
Would somebody read it to us?
Tate spat. Miss Jones stood and faced Kaya, unfolded the paper, and read,
"We, the jury, find Miss Catherine Danielle Clark not guilty as charged in the first-degree murder of Mr. Chase Andrews."
Kaya buckled and sat. Tom followed. Tate blinked. Jody sucked in air. Mabel sobbed. The gallery sat motionless. Surely they had misunderstood.
"Did she say not guilty?"
A stream of whispers quickly rose in pitch and volume to angry questions. Mr. Lane called out,
"This ain't right!"
The judge hammered his gavel,
"Silence!" "Miss Clark, the jury has found you not guilty as charged. You are free to go, and I apologize on behalf of this state that you served 2 months in jail. Jury, we thank you for your time and for serving this community. Court dismissed."
A small covey gathered around Chase's parents. Patty Love wept. Sarah Singletary scowled like everybody else, but discovered that she was greatly relieved. Miss Pansy hoped no one saw her jaw relax. A lone tear trailed down Mrs. Culpepper's cheek, and then a shadow smile for the little swamp truant escaping again. A group of men in overalls stood near the back.
"Them jurors have some explaining to do. Can't Eric declare a mistrial? Do the whole thing over?" "No, remember, can't be tried for murder twice. She's free. Got away with the whole thing. It's the sheriff who messed it up for Eric. Couldn't keep his story straight. Kept making it up as he went. Theory this, theory that. Been strutting around like he's on gun smoke."
But this small band of disgruntlement fell apart quickly. Some wandering out the door, talking about work to catch up on, how the rain had cooled things down. Jody and Tate had rushed through the wooden gate to the defense table. Scupper, Jumpin', Mabel, and Robert followed and encircled Kaya. They did not touch her, but stood close as she sat there unmoving. Jody said,
"Kaya, you can go home. Do you want me to drive you?"
"Yes, please."
Kaya stood and thanked Robert for coming all the way from Boston. He smiled.
"You just forget about this nonsense and continue your amazing work."
She touched Jumpin's hand, and Mabel hugged her into her cushy bosom. Then Kaya turned to Tate.
"Thank you for the things you brought me."
She turned to Tom and lost words. He simply enfolded her in his arms. Then she looked at Scupper. She'd never been introduced to him, but knew from his eyes who he was. She nodded a soft thank you. And to her surprise, he put his hand on her shoulder and squeezed gently. Then, following the bailiff,
She walked with Jody toward the back door of the courtroom, and as she passed the window sill, reached out and touched Sunday Justice's tail. He ignored her, and she admired his perfect pretense of not needing goodbye. When the door opened, she felt the breath of the sea on her face. Chapter 55 Grass Flowers, 1970. As Jody's truck bumped off the pavement onto the sandy marsh road, he talked gently to Kaya, saying she'd be fine. It would just take some time. She scanned cattails and egrets, pines and ponds flashing past, craned her neck to watch two beavers paddling. Like a migrating tern who has flown 10,000 miles to her natal shore, her mind pounded with the longing and expectation of home. She barely heard Jody's prattle, wished he would be quiet and listen to the wilderness within him. Then he might see. Her breath caught as Jody turned the last bend of the winding lane, and the old shack came into view, waiting there beneath the oaks. The Spanish moss tossed gently in the breeze above the rusted roof, and the heron balanced on one leg in the shadows of the lagoon. As soon as Jody stopped the truck, Kaya jumped out and ran into the shack, touching the bed, the table, the stove. Knowing what she would want, he'd left a bag of crumbs on the counter. And finding new energy, she ran to the beach with it, tears streaming her cheeks as the gulls flew toward her from up and down the shore. Big Red landed and tramped around her, his head bobbing. Kneeling on the beach, surrounded by a bird frenzy, she trembled.
I never asked people for anything. Maybe now they'll leave me alone.
Jody took her few belongings into the house and made tea in the old pot. He sat at the table and waited. Finally, he heard the porch door open, and as she stepped into the kitchen, she said,
"Oh, you're still here."
Of course he was still there. His truck was in plain view outside. "Please sit down a minute, would you?" he said. "I'd like to talk." She didn't sit.
"I'm fine, Jody. Really."
"So does that mean you want me to go?" "Kaya, you've been alone in that cell for 2 months, thinking a whole town was against you. You've hardly let anyone visit you. I understand all that, I do, but I don't think I should drive away and leave you alone. I want to stay with you a few days. Would that be okay?"
"I've lived alone almost all my life, not 2 months. And I didn't think, I knew a whole town was against me."
"Kaya, don't let this horrible thing drive you further from people. It's been a soul-crushing ordeal, but this seems to be a chance to start over. The verdict is maybe their way of saying they will accept you."
"Most people don't have to be acquitted of murder to be accepted."
"I know, and you have every reason in the world to hate people. I don't blame you, but..."
"That's what nobody understands about me." She raised her voice. "I never hated people. They hated me. They laughed at me. They left me. They harassed me. They attacked me. Well, it's true. I learned to live without them. Without you, without Ma, or anybody."
He tried to hold her, but she jerked away.
"Jody, maybe I'm just tired right now. In fact, I'm exhausted. Please, I need to get over all this. The trial, jail, the thought of being executed by myself. Because by myself is all I've ever known. I don't know how to be consoled. I'm too tired to even have this conversation.
Her voice trailed off. She didn't wait for an answer, but walked from the shack and into the oak forest. Knowing it was futile, he didn't go after her. He would wait. The day before, he'd supplied the shack with groceries, just in case of acquittal, and now set about chopping vegetables for her favorite, homemade chicken pie. But as the sun set, he couldn't stand keeping her from her shack another minute, so he left the hot, bubbling pie on the stovetop and walked out the door. She had circled to the beach, and when she heard his truck driving slowly down the lane, she ran home. Whiffs of golden pastry filled the shack to the ceiling, but Kaya still wasn't hungry. In the kitchen, she took out her paints and planned her next book on marsh grasses. People rarely noticed grasses except to mow, trample, or poison them. She swept her brush madly across the canvas in a color more black than green. Dark images emerged, maybe dying meadows under storm cells. It was hard to tell. She dropped her head and sobbed.
Why am I angry now? Why now? Why was I so mean to Jody?
Limp, she slid to the floor like a rag doll. Curling into a ball, still crying, she wished she could snuggle with the only one who'd ever accepted her as she was. But the cat was back at the jail. Just before dark, Kaya walked back to the beach where the gulls were preening and settling in for the night. As she waded into the surf, shards of shells and chips of crabs brushed her toes as they tumbled back to the sea. She reached down and picked up two pelican feathers, just like the one Tate had put in the P section of the dictionary he had given her for Christmas years ago. She whispered a verse by Amanda Hamilton.
You came again, blinding my eyes, like the shimmer of sun upon the sea. Just as I feel free, the moon casts your face upon the sill. Each time I forget you, your eyes haunt my heart, and it falls still. And so, farewell, until the next time you come, until at last I do not see you.
The next morning before dawn, Kaya sat up in her porch bed and breathed the rich scents of the marsh into her heart. As faint light filtered into the kitchen, she cooked herself some grits, scrambled eggs, and biscuits, as light and fluffy as Ma's. She ate every bite. Then, as the sun rose, she rushed to her boat and chugged across the lagoon, dipping her fingers into the clear, deep water. Churning through the channel, she spoke to the turtles and egrets and lifted her arms high above her head. Home.
I'll collect all day. Anything I want, she said.
Deeper in her mind was the thought that she might see Tate. Maybe he'd be working nearby, and she'd come across him. She could invite him back to the shack to share the chicken pie Jody had baked. Less than a mile away, Tate waded through shallow water, dipping samples in tiny vials. A wake of gentle ripples fanned out from each step, from each dip. He planned to stay near Kaya's place. Maybe she'd boat out into the marsh and they'd meet. If not, he'd go to her shack that evening. He hadn't decided exactly what he'd say to her, but kissing some sense into her came to mind. In the distance, an angry engine roared, higher pitched and much louder than a motorboat, defeating the soft sounds of the marsh. He tracked the noise as it moved in his direction, and suddenly one of those new airboats, which he hadn't seen, raced into view. It glided and gloated above the water, above even the grasses, sending behind a fantail of spray, emitting the noise of 10 sirens. Crushing shrubs and grasses, the boat broke its own trail across the marsh and then sped across the estuary. herons and egrets squawking. Three men stood at its helm, and seeing Tate, they turned in his direction. As they neared, he recognized Sheriff Jackson, his deputy, and another man. The flashy boat sat back on its haunches as it slowed and eased near. The sheriff shouted something to Tate, but even cupping his ears with his hands and leaning toward them, he couldn't hear above the din. They maneuvered even closer until the boat wallowed next to Tate, sloshing water up his thighs. The sheriff leaned down, hollering. Nearby, Kaya had also heard the strange boat, and as she boated toward it, she saw it approaching Tate. She backed into a thicket and watched him take in the sheriff's words, then stand very still, head lowered, shoulders sagging in surrender. Even from this distance, she read despair in his posture. The sheriff shouted again, and Tate finally reached up and let the deputy pull him into the boat. The other man hopped into the water and climbed into Tate's cruiser. Chin lowered, eyes downcast. Tate stood between the two uniformed men as they turned around and sped back through the marsh toward Barkley Cove, followed by the other man driving Tate's boat. Kaya stared until both boats disappeared behind a point of eelgrass. Why had they apprehended Tate? Was it something to do with Chase's death? Had they arrested him? Agony ripped her. Finally, after a lifetime, she admitted it was the chance of seeing Tate, the hope of rounding a creek bend and watching him through reeds, that had pulled her into the marsh every day of her life since she was 7. She knew his favorite lagoons and paths through difficult quagmires, always following him at a safe distance, sneaking about, stealing love, never sharing it. You can't get hurt when you love someone from the other side of an estuary. All the years she rejected him, she survived because he was somewhere in the marsh, waiting. But now perhaps he would no longer be there. She stared at the fading noise of the strange boat. Jumpin' knew everything. He'd know why the sheriff had taken Tate in and what she could do about it. She pull-cranked her engine and sped through the marsh. Chapter 56 The Night Heron, 1970. The Barkley Cove graveyard trailed off under tunnels of dark oaks. Spanish moss hung in long curtains, creating cave-like sanctuaries for old tombstones. The remains of a family here, a loner there, in no order at all. Fingers of gnarled roots had torn and twisted gravestones into hunched and nameless forms. Markers of death all weathered into nubbins by elements of life. In the distance, the sea and sky sang too bright for this serious ground. Yesterday, the cemetery moved with villagers, like constant ants, including all the fishermen and shopkeepers who had come to bury Scupper. People clustered in awkward silence as Tate moved among familiar townspeople and unfamiliar relatives. Ever since the sheriff found him in the marsh to tell him his father had died, Tate simply stepped and acted as guided, a hand behind his back, a nudge to his side. He remembered none of it, and walked back to the cemetery today to say goodbye. During all those months, pining for Kaya, then trying to visit her in jail, he'd spent almost no time with Scupper. Guilt and regret needed clawing away. Had he not been so obsessed with his own heart, perhaps he would have noticed his father was failing. Before her arrest, Kaya had shown signs of coming back, gifting him a copy of her first book, coming onto his boat to look through the microscope, laughing at the hat toss. But once the trial began, she had pulled away more than ever. Jail could do that to a person, he thought. Even now, walking toward the new grave, carrying a brown plastic case. He found himself thinking more of Kaya than of his dad, and swore at that. He approached the fresh scarred mound under the oaks, the wide sea beyond. The grave lay next to his mother's, his sister's on the far side, all enclosed in a small wall of rough stones and mortar embedded with shells. Enough space left for him. It didn't feel as if his dad were here at all. "I should have had you cremated like Sam McGee," Tate said, almost smiling. Then, looking over the ocean, he hoped Scupper had a boat wherever he was. A red boat. He set the plastic case, a battery-operated record player, on the ground next to the grave and put a 78 on the turntable. The needle arm wobbled, then dropped. And Mlitsa Kuryus's silvery voice lifted over the trees. He sat between his mother's grave and the flower-covered mound. Oddly, the sweet, freshly turned earth smelled more like a beginning than an end. Talking out loud, head low, he asked his dad to forgive him for spending so much time away. And he knew Scupper did. Tate remembered his dad's definition of a man. One who can cry freely, feel poetry and opera in his heart, and do whatever it takes to defend a woman. Scupper would have understood tracking love through mud. Tate sat there quite a while, one hand on his mother, the other on his father. Finally, he touched the grave one last time, walked back to his truck, and drove to his boat at the town wharf. He would go back to work, immerse himself in squirming life forms. Several fishermen walked to him on the dock, and he stood awkwardly, accepting condolences just as awkward. Head low, determined to leave before anyone else approached, he stepped onto the aft deck of his cabin cruiser. But before he sat behind the wheel, he saw a pale brown feather resting on the seat cushion. He knew right away it was the soft breast feather of a female night heron, a long-legged, secretive creature who lives deep in the marsh alone. Yet here it was too near the sea. He looked around. No, she wouldn't be here, not this close to town. He turned the key, churned south through the sea, and finally the marsh. Going too fast in the channels, he brushed past low branches that slapped at the boat. The agitated wake sloshed against the bank as he pulled into her lagoon and tied his boat next to hers. Smoke rose from the shack's chimney, billowing and free. "Kaya!" he yelled. "Kaya!" She opened the porch door and stepped under the oak. She was dressed in a long white skirt and pale blue sweater, the colors of wings, hair falling about her shoulders. He waited for her to walk to him, then took her shoulders and held her against his chest, then pushed back.
"I love you, Kaya. You know that. You've known it for a long time."
"You left me like all the others," she said.
"I will never leave you again."
"I know," she said.
"Kaya, do you love me? You've never spoken those words to me."
"I've always loved you. Even as a child, in a time I don't remember, I already loved you."
She dipped her head.
"Look at me," he said gently.
She hesitated, face downcast.
"Kaya, I need to know that the running and hiding are over. That you can love without being afraid."
She lifted her face and looked into his eyes, then led him through the woods to the oak grove, the place of the feathers. Chapter 57 The Firefly. They slept the first night on the beach, and he moved into the shack with her the next day, packing and unpacking within a single tide, as sand creatures do. As they walked along the tide line in late afternoon, he took her hand and looked at her.
Will you marry me, Kaya?
We are married, like the geese, she said.
Okay, I can live with that.
Each morning they rose at dawn, and while Tate percolated coffee, Kaya fried corn fritters in Ma's old iron skillet, blackened and dented, or stirred grits and eggs as sunrise eased over the lagoon. The heron posing one-legged in the mist. They cruised estuaries, waded waterways, and slipped through narrow streams, collecting feathers and amoebas. In the evenings, they drifted in her old boat until sunset, then swam naked in moonlight, or loved in beds of cool ferns. Archibald Lab offered Kaya a job, but she turned it down and continued writing her books. She and Tate hired the fix-it man again, and he built a lab and studio of raw wood, hand-hewn posts, and tin roof for her behind the shack. Tate gave her a microscope and installed work tables, shelves, and closets for her specimens, trays of instruments and supplies. Then they refurbished the shack, adding a new bedroom and bath, a larger sitting room. She insisted on keeping the kitchen as it was, and the exterior unpainted, so that the dwelling, more of a cabin now, remained weathered and real. From a phone in Sea Oaks, she called Jody and invited him and his wife Libby for a visit. The four of them explored the marsh and fished some. When Jody pulled in a large bream, Kaya squealed, "Looky there, you got one, big as Alabama." They fried up fish and hush puppies big as goose eggs. Kaya never went to Barkley Cove again in her life. And for the most part, she and Tate spent their time in the marsh alone. The villagers saw her only as a distant shape gliding through fog. And over the years, the mysteries of her story became legend, told over and over with buttermilk pancakes and hot pork sausages at the diner. The theories and gossip over how Chase Andrews died never stopped. As time passed, most everyone agreed the sheriff never should have arrested her. After all, there was no hard evidence against her, no real proof of a crime. It had been truly cruel to treat a shy, natural creature that way. Now and then, a new sheriff, Jackson was never elected again, would open the folder, make some inquiries about other suspects, but not much came of it. Over the years, the case, too, eased into legend. And though Kaya was never completely healed from the scorn and suspicion surrounding her, a soft contentment, a near happiness, settled into her. Kaya lay on the soft duff near the lagoon one afternoon, waiting for Tate to return from a collecting trip. She breathed deep, knowing he would always come back, that for the first time in her life, she would not be abandoned. She heard the deep purr of his cruiser, chugging up the channel, could feel the quiet rumble through the ground. She sat up as his boat pushed through the thickets and waved to him at the helm. He waved back but didn't smile. She stood. He tied to the small wharf he had built and walked up to her on the shore.
Kaya, I'm so sorry. I have bad news.
Jumpin' died last night in his sleep. An ache pushed against her heart. All those who left her had chosen to do so. This was different. This was not rejection. This was like the cooper's hawk returning to the sky. Tears rolled down her cheeks, and Tate held her. Tate and almost everyone in town went to Jumpin's funeral. Kaya did not. But after the services, She walked to Jumpin' and Mabel's house with some blackberry jam long overdue. Kaya paused at the fence. Friends and family stood in the dirt yard, swept clean as a whistle. Some talked, some laughed at old Jumpin's stories, and some cried. As she opened the gate, everyone looked at her, then stepped aside to make a path. Standing on the porch, Mabel rushed to Kaya. They hugged, rocking back and forth, crying.
"Lord, he loved you like his own daughter," Mabel said.
"I know," Kaya said, "and he was my pa."
Later, Kaya walked to her beach and said farewell to Jumpin' in her own words, in her own way, alone. And as she wandered the beach remembering Jumpin', thoughts of her mother pushed into her mind. As though Kaya were once again a little girl of six, she saw Ma walking down the sandy lane in her old gator shoes, maneuvering the deep ruts. But in this version, Ma stopped at the end of the trail and looked back, waving her hand high in farewell. She smiled at Kaya, turned onto the road, and disappeared into the forest. And this time, finally, it was okay. With no tears or censure, Kaya whispered,
"Goodbye, Ma."
She thought of the others briefly, Pa, her brother and sisters. But she didn't have enough of that bygone family to bid farewell. That regret faded too when Jody and Libby began bringing their two children, Murph and Mindy, to visit Kaya and Tate several times a year. Once again, the shack swelled with family around the old cook stove, serving up Ma's corn fritters, scrambled eggs, and sliced tomatoes. But this time, there was laughter and love. Barkley Cove changed over the years. A man from Raleigh built a fancy marina where Jumpin' Shack had leaned for more than 100 years. With bright blue awnings over each slip, yachts could pull in. Boaters from up and down the coastline moseyed up to Barkley Cove and paid $3.50 for an espresso. Little sidewalk cafes with smart-colored umbrellas and art galleries with seascapes sprouted on Main. A lady from New York opened a gift shop that sold everything the villagers didn't need but every tourist had to have. Almost every shop had a special table displaying the books by Katherine Danielle Clark, local author, award-winning biologist. Grits were listed on the menus as polenta in mushroom sauce and cost $6. And one day, some women from Ohio walked into the doggone beer hall, never imagining they were the first females to pass through the door, and ordered spicy shrimp and paper boats and beer, now on draft. Adults of either sex or any color can walk through the door now, but the window, which was cut out of the wall so that women could order from the sidewalk, is still there. Tate continued his job at the lab, and Kaya published 7 more award-winning books. And though she was granted many accolades, including an honorary doctorate from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, she never once accepted the invitations to speak at universities and museums. Tate and Kaya hoped for a family, but a child never came. The disappointment wove them closer together, and they were seldom separated for more than a few hours of any day. Sometimes Kaya walked alone to the beach, and as the sunset streaked the sky, she felt the waves pounding her heart. She'd reach down and touch the sand, then stretch her arms toward the clouds, feeling the connections. Not the connections Ma and Mabel had spoken of. Kaya never had her troop of close friends, nor the connections Jody described, for she never had her own family. She knew the years of isolation had altered her behavior until she was different from others. but it wasn't her fault she'd been alone. Most of what she knew, she'd learned from the wild. Nature had nurtured, tutored, and protected her when no one else would.